As I said, it's one of the first questions I always receive when I begin my Shakespeare course, and that is, did this guy really write the plays? And as I tried to make clear, yes, there's no evidence to the contrary. This claim first came up in the latter part of the 18th century, at least a century and a half after his death. No one ever raised such a question during his own lifetime. It is largely an American phenomenon, and the wide number of candidates reveals this idea as being a ridiculous one. But I'm going to say some things tonight about why the world continues to want to discredit this man, even as he is honored by many as possibly the greatest writer who ever lived. There is a counter movement, and that counter movement has become particularly strong in our own time. And they want to destroy that reputation. They very much want to pull the man down. And I would say that that began some time ago, and the fact of making this absurd claim that someone other than William Shakespeare wrote the plays is part of this ongoing effort of destruction. I want to begin tonight with another question that for many people is inconsequential, but I think is essential for all of us as Catholics. If we can say with certainty that Shakespeare was Shakespeare and did write the plays that carry his name, a statement of the obvious, but again, given the world we live in, we often have to state the obvious. It is a more difficult question to try to prove that Shakespeare was Catholic. A great deal of controversy has surrounded the question. And while it at this juncture, it will not be until Judgment Day we will have definitive proof in terms of an answer to that question. What I want to begin with tonight is give some evidence as to why I make the claim that Shakespeare was most certainly Catholic. There are some areas of speculation. I won't get into those. I may mention them, but they have to remain speculation. What I'm going to give you tonight are the facts, and nothing but the facts. Like those of you that remember Dragnet back in the 50s, these are just the facts. These are the things that we know for certain, and from those facts that we do have, absolutely clear and substantiated, I believe it is possible to build a case. Let's start with the lineage. Let's start with the heritage. And I go back to the two grandfathers. There was Richard Shakespeare, the paternal grandfather, who worked on a very elaborate and well-maintained estate just outside of Stratford. That estate belonged to the Arden family, Robert Arden, to be specific. Robert Arden was a gentleman. So that you have, and the maternal grandfather. So with the two grandfathers, you have on the maternal side, on his mother's side, a gentleman, a landowner. On his father's side, a worker on that estate. Shakespeare's father, son of one of the workers on that estate, married the daughter. Her name was Mary Arden. This is a class question. It did happen. It was not terribly unusual. But one would assume the possibility of something a little unusual here. What might have made it possible? We know for certain that the Arden family were devout Catholics. That's on record. They were one of the most powerful families in the Warwickshire area, openly Catholic at a time when the persecution had begun. England rife with religious struggles, religious warfare, the new religion being imposed, and many prominent families clinging to the Catholic faith and making that faith something that was well publicized. The Arden family was one of those families. This is speculation on the professor's part. What might be one reason why we could have this slight mismatch in terms of social standing? Probably because, as I will attempt to show, John Shakespeare was also a devout Catholic, a very devout Catholic. So that I view the marriage of Shakespeare's parents as a Catholic marriage, and we have it as a certainty on the mother's side. Now, after the marriage, John and Mary Shakespeare moved into Stratford. That time, a small town by our standards, a good-sized town in England in the latter part of the 16th century, about 1,500 inhabitants. And during that time, John Shakespeare became a very prominent figure in the town. Held a number of offices, was on the little council that ran the city, and for a time was high bailiff in Stratford, the highest official in the city, which means he was extremely prominent. In 1577, or 1578, right about that time, there is a significant and recorded decline in the family fortunes. Not just in terms of money, but also in terms of his prominence and standing within the town. It's noticed first because he was constantly absent from the little council meetings. We have the records where before he was always a member of the council, he begins to be absent. He has to mortgage a bit of his wife's property, meaning they ran into financial troubles, which is odd because for a while he ran a thriving business in town as a glover, making gloves. A prosperous man within the town, which is one reason he was elected as chosen to be high bailiff. And then we find that even though he was an alderman in one section of the city, he is replaced. At this exact same time, 1577, 1578, there are records of a major attack on public Catholics in Warwickshire. Those Catholics who were openly professing their faith at that time began to suffer consequences. Such things as paying penalties, paying fines, losing positions. We cannot say, because we don't have an actual statement that says John Shakespeare lost his position and had financial hardship because of this, but it is only logical. It is only logical. And we have the sense that the Shakespeare family suffered persecution because of the Catholic faith. We know a couple of other things about John. We know he was a recusant. When the new Mass, sound familiar? When the new Mass was instituted in England, it came to the point where because so many were reluctant to attend, it became a mandate. You were told you would attend. And if you didn't, you had to pay a fine. There was still some degree of freedom. That is, you could choose not to attend that new Protestant Anglican Mass. You could still, as a Catholic, say, no, I will not attend that. But if you did, you paid a fine and your name went on a list. John Shakespeare's name appears on that list. He was paying a fine rather than attend the new service. Point. Shakespeare's father was Catholic to the point where he actually put up money and because he refused to attend the new service. Now, that campaign continued. That campaign against Catholics and all things Catholic continued throughout the countryside. Let me recommend a book to you if you don't know it. It's called The Stripping of the Altars by a British historian named Eamon, E-A-M-O-N, Duffy. Last name Duffy. He is a historian. He's not a Catholic, but he has written one of the most remarkable books in recent history studies about the destruction of the faith in England and its consequences. It's an extraordinary book, a brilliant book. I recommend it to you very highly. And what you see in that book, not just the concerted effort to stamp out the Catholic faith, but the reluctance of the people to give up their habits of worship and that faith that they believed in. It was a major battle. But it also means that as the battle was going on, they tried to wipe out everything. One thing that was wiped out after centuries of great popularity were what were called the Corpus Christi plays. These had become extraordinarily popular throughout England. They had begun in the Middle Ages, sometime in the 14th century. And what they were, the plays that were celebrated, that were performed on Corpus Christi Day, as part of the religious celebrations. It had developed over time that there were centers where these plays would be done in England. Five or six different centers. We know that they were in York, they were in Coventry. And families would gather together, go to these towns for that special day, and then watch these plays as they were presented. The Corpus Christi plays that were presented were often called mystery plays, mystery referring to the guilds of the time, and each guild would take part of the Bible narrative story, often somehow connected with what the guild did. For example, the tanners would often put on the Adam and Eve play with the skins, with the hide. The carpenters would put on the Noah play. So they would. It was the only thing that survives like it. Any of you who have been in the Philadelphia area is the Mummers Parade on New Year's Day, where there are organizations and groups within the city who make these go through these elaborate work sessions all year long to make their little group of banjo players have elaborate costumes. It's just a distant relation of something that began as a very holy occasion, where all those Bible stories were told in sequence in the town, called mystery plays. Now, they were very popular, had become a part of the worship on Corpus Christi Day, and as I mentioned this morning, a way in which the church knew the people could be educated. They are brilliant dramas, many of them, absolutely extraordinary dramas. We're lucky to have a number of them that survived. All anonymous, we don't know who wrote any of them. But they are loaded with good doctrine. Again, let me suggest to you, there's a Penguin paperback volume of these little plays, simply called English Mystery Plays. They are wonderful to put on in a parish. A wonderful activity. You may have to update a couple of the words, the language a little bit old, but it's easy enough to do. Wonderful exercises. I recommend them to you. They are simply marvelous. Now, why am I going through all this? They were being stamped out in the cause of the new faith. They were Catholic. They were part of the Catholic tradition. They were being stamped out. Curiosity. We have a record of where they last survived. And one reason for the persecution that went on in Warwickshire is the faith was particularly strong there. And one indication of that is they refused to give up their Corpus Christi plays. And the last time a complete cycle of plays was presented in England on Corpus Christi Day was in Coventry, right near Stratford. Shakespeare would have been 11 years old. With a devout Catholic father, we can presume that for those 11 years on Corpus Christi Day, the family went to Coventry, and as part of the Corpus Christi celebration, watched the dramatic pageant, watched these plays. Shakespeare learned to write plays, I would say, had ingrained in him patterns, themes, and ideas by watching the medieval mystery plays. And through, again, one of those wonderful graces, the last place those plays were performed were right near his hometown. So that kid would have a chance to go and see them after they'd been wiped out everywhere else in England. We have that. When he went to London, there are a number, we have what are called the missing years, I'll give some other details about when I am simply looking at Catholic connections. When he got to London, we know he was associated with a number of prominent families. As he became more well known as a poet, and better known as a playwright, he was taken in and supported by a number of families. Those families all have one thing in common. They were prominent Catholic families. I won't go through the list of them, but those families that this young man associated with, and was known to have connections with when he arrived in London, were Catholic families. And it makes sense, a young man coming from the provinces, beginning to gain some notoriety, who takes him in? His own. And those bonds are established. We know about them. Now, I'm going to jump ahead a bit because the fact of the matter is, for most of his career, there's very little, although I'll come back to that later, because I think there is something. I'm just talking documentary evidence of a kind. What do we know during those years? Well, we know he was probably not courageous. I would say we also know he struggled with doubt. I'll talk about that in one of my later lectures. And not inappropriately so, given what was happening in terms of the intellectual turmoil, the historical turmoil of the time. But we do know that at the end of his career, after 20 years as a prominent playwright, he had raised the family to the level of gentlemen, something that his father had tried to do many years before and had not been successful at. Shakespeare finally achieved. He made some money and bought property back in Stratford. His family stayed in Stratford while he was in London. Bought himself a good bit of property and clearly planned to retire in Stratford, which he did when he made a rather deliberate retirement and returned to Stratford to live out his remaining years. But then there was this one curiosity. And for me, this is the clincher. Just before he left London, when he was busy buying as much land and property as Stratford as he could, he bought a house in London, in the Blackfriars region, in 1613. We know that because we've got the contract. He didn't have the full purchase price at the time. He took out a mortgage. He signed it. It's one of six signatures we have. And it's on the contract. And the puzzle had long been, why, when he was buying all this property in Stratford, building a new house in Stratford, leaving London, did he buy a house in London? And then simply give it to friends to use, who then passed it to other friends, who willed it to other friends. He never lived there. He never stayed there. And then it was discovered, when the house was torn down, it had been a mass center. It had been a place in London where priests, coming in violation of the law, from France, from mainland Europe, to say the Mass illegally in England, could go in London and say Mass privately, in hidden circumstances. Before he left London, the last thing Shakespeare did was buy a Mass house. A piece of property where the Mass could be said in secret. For me, that's a clincher. But if you need another one, here it is. We know that. We have one bit of evidence about his death. There are rumors about the death. This is not fact. This comes about 50 years after his death, and the rumor is that two of his good friends, other poets from the time, Michael Drayton and Ben Jonson, came down to wish him a happy birthday in the spring of 1616. They did what old friends do when they get together. They went out to the taverns and drank too much, and the account says Master Shakespeare caught ill and died shortly thereafter. We don't know if that's true or not, but what we do know is after his death, a Protestant minister who was living in Stratford wrote a letter to a friend in another town and stated in disgust in the letter, Master Shakespeare died a papist. There was no reason for him to lie. Absolutely no reason to lie. And in fact, his disgust at the fact that it happened, I take as a sign of the veracity of it, meaning that it was known in Stratford that Shakespeare had died a Catholic. Here's the old professor speculating. This is just speculation on my part. I mentioned the grave site in the little church and the little plaque that is on the grave. Good friend, for Jesus' sake, forbear to dig the dust, enclose it here. Blessed be the man who spares these stones, but cursed be he who moves my bones. As a result, the grave has never been opened. Why put a curse on your own grave at the time of your death? And it went in there at the time of Shakespeare's burial. My guess, he was aware rumors would be circulating in Stratford that he died in the Catholic faith, and someone would try to get into the grave to look for a rosary, a scapular, some proof of the Catholic connection that could have caused trouble for his family. And as a result, he saw to it nobody would go digging around in his grave. And it has not been touched since that day in 1616 when it was sealed. Two other interesting facts. After Shakespeare's death, one of his two surviving children, there was a daughter, Susanna, and then twins, Judith and Hamnet. Hamnet died in 1596 at the age of 11 when he was just a boy. The two daughters survived. Susanna's name appears after Shakespeare's death on a list of recusants, those who refused to attend the new mass and paid a fine. His father shows up on the list. His daughter shows up on the list. The missing link, clearly, is William Shakespeare himself. We don't have his name on a list, but then he was in a very awkward position. He made his living working at the behest of the royalty, first for Queen Elizabeth as one of the Lord Chamberlain's men, and then when James I came to power as one of the king's men, and it would have been very unseemly to have that sort of open protest. Again, as I said, he wasn't a courageous man. And we also know that he worked on the King James Bible. It is not surprising that the greatest poets and writers of the day had their hand in that. And the glory of the King James Bible has always been its literary quality. Absolutely gorgeous passages in there. It is obviously, in terms of doctrine, not all it should be. But as literature, it is beautiful. And there are passages that are beautifully done. Why? Because you had men like Shakespeare. Obviously, the king's putting out a new translation of the Bible that will be called the King James Bible. Who's he going to get to do such things as translate the Psalms? Psalm 46, King James Bible. Count in 46 words from the beginning, you'll find the word shake. Count in 46 words from the end, skipping the salah, the little salah at the end. 46 words in from the end, you'll find the word spear. He buried his signature in the 46th Psalm. He signed it, if you will. It's there. But as with almost everything he did, he hid it. It's buried. It's not forthright. I don't know who first discovered this, but there it is. And the other interesting fact, of course, why the 46th Psalm? Because the King James Bible was published when Shakespeare was 47 years old, and I'll bet you money he was 46 years old, doing his own version of the 46th Psalm, and therefore 46, one of those little numerology things that artists love getting into. But there it is. There it is. So he would do what the king asked him. But again, we know the father, list of recusants, the daughter on the list of recusants. Another thing that happened some years later, and an old house was torn down in Stratford in the 18th century, and what did they uncover? But John Shakespeare's spiritual will. He'd left a legal will disposing of his property. It was very common at this time for those Catholics who wanted to be devout and let it be known that they were devout to make a spiritual will, in which they attest to all the doctrines of the faith on paper and sign it. These wills came originally from Italy, then into France, translated into English, smuggled into England, and they were kept well hidden, but it gave the Catholic soul who signed it the knowledge that, though it had to be done in a hidden fashion, and they kept them secret for family and close friends, there was a record that they had signed, that they held to the doctrines of the Catholic faith. 18th century, house torn down, there it is. What's the signature? John Shakespeare. What's the date? Shortly before his death. Fortunately, the man who discovered it made a copy of it because it vanished almost immediately. Many people saw it. We know it existed. We don't have it. It was gone. It was gone. We know it existed. We have a number of eyewitnesses who saw it. You put all of these facts together, what do you come up with? The man was Catholic, not a courageous Catholic, certainly not a martyr. And it's very clear, it was an age of great martyrs. Edmund Campion was martyred in England while Shakespeare was alive. There is a theory, it's speculation, we can't prove it. the brightest young Catholic men in England were often taken to the North Country, where they stayed and were trained with a prominent family, and then spirited off to France to be trained as seminarians to become priests. It was sort of an underground railroad of getting young men out of England and getting them to seminaries in France. There is a young man who stayed with a prominent family in the north whose name is very like Shakespeare's. It could have well been a pseudonym. Edmund Campion was passing through and in fact was arrested just before he arrived at that family estate. And apparently those young men who were there were quickly spirited away. The theory, just a theory, is that there was a troop of players passing through. Young Shakespeare was sent with a troop of players to London to get him out of there, and the rest is literary history. We don't know. Cannot be proven. It's a theory. An interesting one. There are these kinds of speculations, and others. I won't get into any more of them. But the fact of the matter is, there is enough hard evidence. There is enough hard evidence so that we can say Shakespeare was Catholic. Now, it matters to us. Does it matter in a larger sense? Yes, it does. And I get to my question that I want to address tonight. Why Shakespeare? Why is he so important? Why does he have such prominence? Why do we deal with him? Well, let me begin by quoting one of the literary giants of our own century. I will defer to a higher authority. I'll quote T.S. Eliot. I'll quote T.S. Eliot. One of those artists, as I mentioned this morning, who was not Catholic, but spoke great truths to our time, and from whom we can learn much. Eliot said, "Dante and Shakespeare divide the world between them. There is no third." High praise indeed. Basically meaning, if you want to know everything there is to know from the realm of literature, if you want to read the two wisest men who wrote in the realm of poetry, then read Dante and Shakespeare, and between the two of them, you'll have it all. Now, what's the difference? The difference is very clear. Dante was medieval. Dante was Italian. Dante was Catholic. Dante was there in the midst of that glorious Catholic age and gave voice to it. The Divine Comedy is an extraordinary work, and we have, throughout the history of the Church, many popes who have said that the Divine Comedy is filled with Catholic theology, and it is. And it can still touch readers in a very special and powerful way. Dante's vision is a vision of the supernatural. It is a world that it is a vision that the modern world is not attuned to. You need some Catholic sympathy, or at least a very open mind. I tried for years at the Naval Academy to teach a Dante course, and they kept turning me down. They knew what would happen. They kept turning me down and rejecting it, while black feminist literature courses would get taught. But I'd put in to teach a Dante course, and no, we can't do that. We can't do that. Well, persistence paid off, and finally they said, "Oh, all right, go ahead." And it was after the von Hildebrand Institute had invited me to Italy to lecture on Dante. At which point the department would have looked really stupid. There I go to Italy and lecturing on Dante, and they were saying, "No, you can't teach it here to our students." You know, they would have looked foolish. So at that point they said, "Oh, all right, you can." I had 50 midshipmen sign up. I had two sections of it. Best classes I've ever had. They were wonderful. I had officers who were sitting in. They worked hard. It was very hard work. Most of them had studied Shakespeare with me. So they were willing to listen. Four converts out of the 50. Four. That was within the span of time we were doing the course. I don't know what seeds got scattered or what could happen in the future. It's one of the beauties of teaching. And it's what I've learned. I stand up there and just talk, and I don't know what's going to happen. You know, I'll get a letter years later from a student that will tell me something I said that I don't remember at all. or some event in his own life that has been shaped by something we studied, and I don't remember it at all. So you just scattered the seed, and you know, then it's up to God to let it grow, not whatever, God's grace. In any case, Dante is open and direct. They'll never let me teach that course again. They know what went on. That was it. I mean, there's not a chance. But the difference with Shakespeare is, I can build a case to you that he's Catholic, but the world has enough doubts that, we can't really know. Shakespeare is a figure from 250 years after Dante. The world had changed. And I often describe it this way. If Dante was the great poet who gave us a vision of the supernatural, and laid it out for us in all its theological complexity and all its horror and beauty, Shakespeare is the great secular writer. The mirror he holds up is to nature, not to supernature. And what Shakespeare tells us about is the world in which we find ourselves. But there's a curiosity here. Given that background that I suggest, I would make the claim that one of Shakespeare's legs is firmly rooted in that medieval world. He knew it. He had to have been raised by his parents with a clear sense of the medieval and received much of his drama instruction from medieval plays. The old morality play. We have the hero and we have a good angel and a bad angel who are in combat for the soul of that hero in the morality play. And I'll tell you, you've got Othello. Othello with Desdemona and Iago. I mean, it's boom, it's right there. Othello couldn't have been written without Shakespeare's introduction to the medieval morality play. Boom, it's there. But it's in secular terms, with living characters that we somehow can recognize. And the other foot is anchored in the modern world. He went to London, that London that had become Protestant, filled with money, filled with notions of freedom, filled with all sorts of intellectual ferment, and he became part of it. You had a divided man in many ways. And it is not accidental that the form that attracted him was drama, where ideas are battled out. Drama is the place of conflict. The very form is about different sides, opposing forces, protagonists and antagonists, and I'm making the claim that that was the man. In his very thought, in his upbringing, in what he knew, had learned from his family, had learned from the world around him, and then the world in which he found himself. And boom, the clash occurs. And it gets expressed in drama. The reason Shakespeare is a great teach is that there is enough of the modern in him that he's familiar. They can read these plays, and they are familiar enough because most of the ideas that they are saturated with out there are in there somewhere. The reason Shakespeare is a great subversive is that underlying all of it, what he could never get away from, what he had to give expression to, what assumes primacy in all of the plays but one, is the medieval vision. Is that clear Catholic truth. There is only one play where the modern threatens to swamp the medieval. And of course, that's the play that fascinates the modern world the most, and that's the play where I say the modern world began, and that's Hamlet. And that's Hamlet, the great play of doubt. The great play of doubt, where everything seems to be pulling at the seams and ready to fly apart. I'm going to be doing another one of the little literature seminars over this summer for those seminarians and some Catholic teachers who choose to attend. And I've never had a go at Hamlet here, but I'm going to do that. The play is intimidating. It's extraordinarily difficult and complex. But it haunts us. It continues to haunt us. And it should. And it should. It is loaded with the modern world. But let me give you an example. This is a true story. I had a young midshipman who came into my office one day, just broke down completely and said to me that all he thought about was suicide. He was on the brink of suicide. I handed him Hamlet. Said, you go read it, come back and talk to me. He agreed to do that. And we talked and talked and talked, and suddenly, most famous line in English literature, to be or not to be, that is the question. But where we usually toss it off, or it becomes a joke, Senator Robert Byrd on being interviewed Sunday morning about the president said, well, the question, to remove or not to remove, that is the question. Again, a debasement of the language, that makes it difficult to read the original and take it seriously. But here was a young man in despair on the brink of suicide, and he took those words seriously. And we sat session after session after session talking through Hamlet, and by that, able to make some inroads. And again, as long as they're talking, they're not going to do anything rash. Story goes on. I mean, after some months, he asked if he could go to Mass with me. I said, of course, you can ride along. He sat there as if, like Daniel in the lion's den. It was just, I mean, just rigid, horrified that I don't know what he thought we were going to do to him, but, and then I thought, well, you know, well, at least he got there once. Then he has to go again the next week. Sat there like this. Did this week after week after week after week. I didn't push. I didn't say anything. I just invited him along. He didn't ask questions. I didn't offer any answers. And then one Sunday at the beginning of Mass, he knelt. At that point, I just knew God's grace did it. There it was. And he came into the church. His parents were horrified. To this day, my name cannot be spoken in their home. What they don't know is they might have had a dead son. But as many of you know, that to many wild-eyed Protestants out there, that might have been preferable to being Catholic. That's what we've come to. That's what we've come to. Now, my point is this. With Shakespeare, we have half a modernist. We have half a modern man. But we have half a modern man in combat with medieval Catholic man. And out of that, the Catholic always wins. Always. Because his instincts, his observations were sound enough that, and he was so honest as a writer, that if he were going to put down truth, then a tempter like Iago, who is claiming there is nothing in the world other than sex, it's all sex, that's all it is, and your wife is corrupt and she's been sleeping around, is the villain. In a modern play, it would be a modern counselor helping some person to fulfill himself, okay? You get the same ideas. They are there. They are given voice. They are given expression, and it's villainy. You've got the first and best and most classic example of feminism, but her name is Lady Macbeth, and it's not a pretty sight. But every single idea of the feminist movement is embodied, and when I teach that play, whoa, do they get mad at me. Just furious. And yet they cannot deny the power of what is in the language or what happens in the action of the play. And there it is. So that I can talk about these ideas, and I can talk about them directly, because it's there. And it is there in the way that art should give it to us. It is, if you will, I hate to use anything like computer talk. You know, most of you know how I'm not just incompetent, but anti-computer. But it's like running simulations. You are able to live out things vicariously in literature without having to experience them. It's there before you, and no one did it more honestly or with more complexity or with more absolute profound truth, goodness, and beauty than Shakespeare. There it is. There it is. Now, final bit of evidence, though, and this is the most important. How do we know Shakespeare was Catholic? The plays. That's how we know. I'm just going to give you four quick examples of why I say the plays are Catholic. First of all, I go back to the point I made this morning about our Lord teaching in parables. The need of human nature to hear stories. And the better the story, and the truer the story, the more attractive the story. Shakespeare is one of the great storytellers in the history of the world. And therefore has a particular fascination. But beyond that, his stories are ordered. This may sound crazy. Let me go to Aristotle, the Poetics. My students always laugh when I bring this up. Aristotle's definition of a tragedy. An imitation of an action, which is complete in itself, which has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And they go, yeah, right. Duh. But it is an extraordinary, complex idea. And the complex idea begins with the notion of imitation of an action. Again, holding the mirror up to nature. What are we imitating? How do we imitate it? Is it truthful or not? Okay? That is complete in itself. What does that mean? That means fullness. It is not slanted. It gives us the fullness of perspective. Okay? Don't take this in the wrong way. A problem with almost every saint's life I have ever read is that the good is so good, there is insufficient drawing of the evil. I just never believe the evil. I believe Iago. I believe Macbeth and Lady Macbeth. I believe Richard III. There is a real struggle there. Curiously, the one exception is, I mentioned it this morning, Evil and Waugh's Life of Edmund Campion. The image of Queen Elizabeth that opens that book, her death scene, is about the most horrifying thing in English literature. Don't miss it. And it is not just that she is dying outside the true faith and knows it and for political reasons won't give in. This is a woman who has been consumed by evil. And you somehow recognize the fact this is the woman who killed that great saint, and you have in that book some real balance, some real terror, some genuine evil. I recommend it to you. But it takes an artist to make that completeness. And those who pursue and destroy the saint are filled with the demonic. There's that, it's always, oh, it's easy to write evil characters, but it's hard to write good ones. It's hard to do both. It's difficult to do both. Shakespeare, a master, that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. They laugh. Modern art is consumed in circularity. Works that end right back at their beginning and go round and round. Meaning what? There is absolutely no sense of design, order, consequence to action. There is no teleological understanding of moving towards some point. None of it. And it is fundamentally a rejection of design. It is a rejection of what we as Catholics know, that the world had a beginning, it will go on for a while, and it will have an end. Aristotle, in saying that a great tragedy has a beginning and a middle of an end, is already somehow, in a way that St. Thomas understood, giving us an intimation of what's going to become the fullness of Christian revelation. It is an extraordinarily complex idea. And Shakespeare gives you that completeness in every one of the plays. I mentioned the characters. I admire the Greeks. I love the Greek drama. I'm very fond of the Greek tragedies. But what is missing? That Shakespeare's plays loaded with free will. Every character in every Shakespeare play at every moment is making a choice that is somehow moving him towards a happy, joyous salvation or destruction. Shakespeare was imbued with a sense of the free will that mankind possesses and how we, in making those choices, are making enormous choices that affect not just ourselves, those around us, and the world in which we live. It's everywhere. I'll say more about that when I come to Romeo and Juliet tomorrow. Order, order, order. The plays are ordered. The poetry is ordered. And the vision is an ordered vision. I don't have the time right now. The great speech in Act 1, Scene 3 of Troilus and Cressida. Ulysses gives the speech. It is a vision of the complete ordering of the whole cosmos. It is the closest Shakespeare came to giving us his own sense of what's out there, minus he sets it in the Greeks, okay? It's in the Battle of Troy, so he doesn't have to be accused of anything religious. But it is a vision of order from the top to the bottom, everything in its place. And if you break that chain, okay, untune that string, he says, and hark what discord follows. And there it is. And that order fills every play. It is not a universe filled with random chaos where a bolt out of the blue hit some muck and something sprang to life, and out of non-life came life from one cell that ended differing. Nonsense. It is a created, ordered universe in which human beings have a precise place. It fills the place. And because of that, the notion of authority is everywhere. I'll mention this tomorrow. Greatest examination to my mind of authority ever given is King Lear, without a doubt, without a doubt. And speaks sadly to our own time, sadly to our own time. Finally, language, language. Most of us in our day-to-day life use about 1,000 words in conversation. Most of us have 7,000 to 8,000 to 9,000 words to call upon that we can drag out. The most learned poet who ever wrote in the English language, got doctor's degrees when he was 4 years old. John Milton, used 18,000 words in his works. Shakespeare, 22,000 words in the works. 22,000. It is a cornucopia of language. And what we are learning in the modern world, as language is debased, destroyed, and often disappearing, I'm not joking about that. I more and more see my students addressing each other in grunts. As they are reverting to the animal in everything else, they're reverting to the animal in the ways in which they communicate. I've told this story before. I'll tell it again. I'm teaching sonnet number 18 to my plebes. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. I'm beginning to go through it. I look up. There are two guys in the back sniffing each other's armpits and laughing. I said, gentlemen, thank God you're seated, or given your propensities to be dog-like, who knows what you'd be sniffing. And I went, I said, here I am teaching one of the most beautiful poems in the English language. You're smelling each other's armpits. I said, this is a moment I will not soon forget. This is what we're dealing with out there. This is what we're dealing with out there. But again, that's what they know. My own profession, and I say it to my shame, has unleashed this nonsense of deconstruction. What was a joke in Alice in Wonderland, when Alice meets Humpty Dumpty, and Humpty Dumpty says, when I use a word, it means precisely what I want it to mean, nothing more, nothing less. That is, all meaning is subjective, has now become pop literary theory and is everywhere. And is everywhere. The writer who writes a work knows no more about that work than any reader who chooses to put any meaning on those words. You can see how insidious this is, because it means you can study anything and find meaning in it, because you are the one assigning meaning. That's what's going on out there. Now, why do they hate Shakespeare? For all these reasons. And that may sound odd, but the fact of the matter, in the last few years, when he has become more and more popular, here's a list. Film versions in the last 10 years, A Much Ado About Nothing, A Twelfth Night, A Richard III, A Henry V, two different Hamlets, A Romeo and Juliet, An Othello, in the can about to come out, A Midsummer Night's Dream, A Titus Andronicus, starting filming this month, A Love's Labour's Lost, coming up next year, An As You Like It, A Macbeth. And who's piling into the theaters? Young people. And what are the English departments teaching? Toni Morrison and, popular mechanics and, whatever. It's the equivalent of what went on in the church. God help us in its madness when around the world millions of young people were listening to Gregorian chant and we, the church, is still playing Kumbaya at Mass. They could have packed the churches. But no, not interested. Because those in control knew what would happen if those young souls came into the church and heard Gregorian chant. But the soul was attracted. The English department stopped teaching Shakespeare and they don't like him anymore. And the students flood to the theaters to see him. Arizona State, last semester, ordered one of the theater teachers who taught Shakespeare and stayed Shakespeare, if he was going to do it, he had to change the endings. And he had to make very clear that this was an old-fashioned vision and not appropriate to the modern day. He refused and was demoted. Couldn't produce plays anymore, taken out of the Shakespeare course. The next play they did at Arizona State was called Betty the Yeti, about I'm not making this up, about a crazed outdoorsman, woodsman, who has carnal relations with the abominable snowman, and as a result of it, becomes a sensitive environmentalist. Betty the Yeti, it's called. Currently, English majors in American universities, 27% of English majors, they did a survey, required to read one Shakespeare play at some point in their career. 27% of English majors. The equivalent would be mathematics majors who were required to do one calculus problem during the time of their years as a math major. Okay? They hate him. And they're trying to pull him down. Why? Let me state it succinctly. They have severed every other link with the past. That world of tradition and order and language and beauty and intellectual debate and reason and passion, all in its proper place, has been junked. It's gone. We know that, sadly, even in our own church. We know the attack. There is one thing they haven't nailed yet. That damn William Shakespeare, who is half a lifeline to that past. And so the battle is raging. I'm not joking. The battle is raging to get rid of him. Because once he's gone, we will live in total modernity. Except for an odd eccentric who reads some Dante. Or those weird schismatics who say that old mass off some, okay? I am talking the strange fact that within the last 10 years, you could have seen 1/3 of the Shakespeare canon on the screen in the movie houses. And many of those films were in the top 10 moneymakers, which is why they're doing more of them. It sells. He's a lifeline. They're after him. They want to make the break and the cut. And if they cannot do it in the universities, and they've discovered that it's not working because if they're not being taught it, they'll go into the theaters and see it. They're now beginning to attack on this screen, and I'll explain that when I go into Romeo and Juliet tomorrow morning. I finished right on the button. I promised you I would. I've left some time for questions, though. I'll be very glad to take questions. What I'm going to do tomorrow is talk at length about Romeo and Juliet as an example of what I've been talking about tonight. Okay? Very glad to take questions about whatever. Whatever. Yes?
Could this political correctness be interfering with the language as well?
Yes, it is. It's destroying the language as well. Oh, classic example. Here we go. By the way, I say this. Another reason he shouldn't be taught, he's a racist. Let me explain this. It's not just Othello. I don't know if you're aware, this has happened in the last 2 weeks. And for me, this is the best example of how insane it's gotten out there. City council meeting, Washington, D.C., I live near there. I'm used to any insanity that comes out of that town. This was special. This was prime. We're at the council meeting. A white man who is in charge of some of the budget aspects of running the city, is objecting to the reduction in funding for a particular program. I don't know what the program was. He says, but look, you know, if we keep reducing it at this level, pretty soon we are going to reduce this until it's just down to a niggardly sum that won't be worth anything. Niggardly, of course, meaning miserly, stingy, small, and held in. A black man at the meeting reported him, demanded an investigation, and demanded that he resign from his job for a racial slur. The word niggardly is a medieval word that simply means stingy, miserly. It has no connection whatsoever with the black races, but because the black man, in his ignorance, misunderstood, it was still called a racial slur. The man resigned. This was reported, and I saw debates on television, debates as to whether the white man, improperly using a word that's about 600, 700 years old, had done a great wrong because he should have been racially sensitive enough to recognize that niggardly sounds like nigger, and therefore someone who didn't know the meaning might take it as a racial slur. Now, at this point, the mind is exploding. Last Monday, in the St. Paul Pioneer Press, and then I read the story other places, a Chaucer professor at the University of Wisconsin, a man I had a master's degree there, I never had him in class, I remember him because he actually taught some literature. He wasn't a political critic. He actually went in and taught some literature. Goes into his Chaucer course and is commenting on this and says, niggardly is a medieval word. It comes from the time of Chaucer. Here's its etymology. Here's what it means. A black girl in the class storms up after his lecture and says, I am humiliated. Don't you ever use a word like that again, and rushes out of the room. He's going. So the next class, he says, I did not mean to offend anyone in the previous class. The point I was making in analyzing the origins of the word was to point it out had nothing to do with race. Niggardly has nothing to do with race. She stands up, weeps, screams at him, runs out of the room, comes back with three black friends who confront him and report him to the faculty senate at the University of Wisconsin, who are taking up the issue and on March 1st voting on a resolution that will forbid faculty to deliberately offend students in class, even inadvertently. So it dawns on me, I'm thinking around, and sure enough, Act 3, Scene 1 of Hamlet, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are talking to King Claudius, and the king is worried about Hamlet's behavior. Have they found out why he's behaving in such a bizarre nature? And the queen says, did he receive you well? Rosencrantz says, most like a gentleman, Guildenstern, but with much forcing of his disposition. Rosencrantz, niggard of question, but of our demands, most free in his reply. Well, there it is. And it's not even the adverb form. It's Shakespeare, horrible racist. The insanity is so overwhelming. How do you fight back? Directly. And with assertions that language has meaning. And you understand in saying that, the claim that is being made is that there is objective meaning. There is objective truth. That words indeed are signifiers, and what they signify is something very specific. And at that moment, this insanity of subjectivism has now reached the point that insults are in the ear of the listener. If we get into that, anybody can be jailed at any time for saying anything. Horrifying. It's because we've destroyed language. And it is not accidental, because we understand, I said this morning that one way in which we were made in the image and likeness of God is that we are makers. We are creators. We make things. Another way we know is we have language. And language allows us to reason. You take away the word as signifier, you use reason. And it is not accidental that the Logos is there. At the beginning of the Gospel of John, and that the Word came and dwelt among us, that Word is not accidental. That Word is filled with implications, and that is what is being attacked. We as Catholics know that. That's what's being attacked. When I force my students to read a Shakespeare sonnet and say definitively what the words mean, not that there isn't some range of response, but that the words carry definitive meaning, I am performing a Catholic action, insisting on the objectivity of the thing signified, the importance of the word, and a rational, reasonable response to what that word says, means. There is meaning. There is truth. It is objective. And here's a place we can start insisting on that. And they don't like him because he was so specific. There are so many words. There's such variety. There's such richness. There's such beauty. They hate it. They hate it. Not the students, if they're shown it in a proper way, but my colleagues, who really would much prefer that I teach black lesbian midget literature. Yeah, just. It's madness out there.